Turen er kommet til Europa, Australien og Japan i vores sommerturné rundt på verdens markeder, hvor vi jo startede i Mellemøsten med Arman, vi fortsatte til USA sammen med Jakob, og senest der besøgte vi Asien sammen med Allan. Denne her episode kommer lige om lidt til at foregå på engelsk, og det er fordi, at Pete, som jeg har med i studiet, han er den her fantastiske kapacitet, der ved så ufattelig meget, at jeg synes, det var synd, at I gik glip af ham her i den her serie, hvor jeg har snakket med de fleste af vores porteføljeforvaltere, bare på grund af sproget. Pete, han er uddannet fra Dublin i 91 i økonomi, og har så arbejdet som analytiker lige siden, så det er jo blevet til en rum år. Faktisk siden 97 som porteføljeforvalter, og her i Sea Worldwide-huset er Pete en del af vores team, der sidder med den globale portefølje, altså den globale fond, og de strategier, der omgiver den, som en del af det forvalter-team, og der er de fire. Og hej til dig, Pete.
Hi.
Hi. So we're going to do the rest in English, as I just mentioned to the listeners. And you're from Ireland?
That's correct.
Yes. And normally we do this in Danish, so you are our first guest who's allowed to speak English.
I feel very special.
But you should, because we have quite a few people in the house that speaks English that are not allowed to guest the podcast. But we have these meetings every other Thursday, and you always have so much to share at those meetings. And everyone was saying that if you want to talk about these places, Pete is the guy to go with. So that's why we've extended this podcast to be in English for once. And I hope that you that listen in is okay with that. Give it a go, and then let me know if it's okay or not for another time. So we're about to talk about Australia, Japan, and Europe. That's a lot of places. I just want to start off with acknowledging, because we've talked about the States with Jacob here from the house, and that's a bit more together, or Japan and Australia, Europe, it's also far away from each other. So can you say anything about why you think you were the guy to go to with those places, and why they have been bundled together?
Well, I could ask you the same question, but we'll try and give it our best shot.
Yeah. So how many people, that's been my first question in the other episodes, how many people live in these regions or these countries?
So we're talking about two countries, Japan and Australia, and a region, Europe, which, depending on how you define Europe, can either be 44 countries or 27 countries. And so I guess in the interest of this podcast not turning into a more than 45-minute podcast, we might try and compress it a little bit. From investment terms, if we start off with Europe, we normally talk about the European Union. There are other interesting countries in Europe, such as Turkey, but they tend to be more emerging market-type countries, and they would be covered by some of my colleagues, such as Aman, etc., who runs our emerging market strategy. I mean, in terms of Europe, if you take out those sort of other countries, you've got 27 countries, which represent around 300 million people. It's one of the largest, I guess, economic blocks in the world. In terms of Japan, you have 124 million people, and Australia looks pretty small then when you compare it to these two big economies at 27 million people.
And the now that it's been bundled, so you get to or have to say something about all of this. Do they have the same economies, or what are the? I guess there's a lot of differences, but what is it that makes them the same?
So I suppose comparing a region of 24 or 27 countries with two separate countries, again, in the interest of trying to be brief and sum it up, I might just consider Europe as being one country. That's not what it is.
And, no, but it's
I
fine.
Think it's, this. But just to compare them at a broad level. So if you compare, for example, Europe, Japan, and Australia, they're all developed economies. At a broad level, you know, in terms of primary shares of the sector, it's very low. It's fishing and agriculture only represent single digits in terms of the percentage, and that goes for all three. In terms of secondary industries such as construction, manufacturing, that tends to be around 20% or so. And then there, where they are all primarily focused is on service economies. And that's pretty much like any developed economy. So when I say services, I'm talking about things like finance, information technology, education, healthcare, etc. And so if you were to compare that with other economies around the world, so for example, the two biggest economies, which may be one of your questions later on, but China and the US, China and the US, China would be more extreme in terms of its focus on service economies, in service industries. Whereas in terms of the US is more focused on service economies, whereas if you look at China, it's much more a secondary economy focus. So 40% to 50% of China is in construction and manufacturing, which is very different. So,
and that was 20% in Europe, Australia, Japan.
Correct. So if you look at all of those, they are similar. And then they have nuances above and beyond that, but we'll get into that.
So what do the economies of Europe, Australia and Japan look like, and how do they differ economically from for instance US and China?
Yeah, so as I said, China, you know, the US and Europe are the three biggest economies in the world if you want to consider again Europe as being one economy. I would say the US and Europe are very similar. US is much more geared towards technology, whereas Europe is geared more towards healthcare. It's geared more towards, I suppose, industrial luxury type products. And then if you look at the actual social fabrics of the different economies, again, they're all very different. I would say in the case of all of the three economies we're talking about today, Europe, Japan and Australia, they have far more of a social structure to the economy. So they focus on the social state provides education, it tends to provide healthcare. And that's the same in all three economies. And that would differ very much between China and the US, where they're a little bit more similar. Even though China and the US are very different in terms of how advanced they are, in terms of social structure, you know, education, etc., tends to be out of pocket in both countries. Healthcare tends to be out of pocket. And so they would be the way they would differ.
That's very interesting. And I also just were thinking, so it's like what we prioritize as, like if we zoom in on Denmark, so healthcare is very important to us. It's like the whole fabric of the country that we can count on getting to a hospital if we're sick, and not focus that much on developing new technology as the US. So it makes a lot of sense when you like put it up so directly.
Yeah, well, I think it's no big secret, and it would the social fabric is prioritized higher in Japan, Europe, Denmark obviously being an extreme, but throughout Europe, I think it's fair to say. Canada would also be similar to that as well. And then the US and China, you know, even though China is considered a socialist economy by some people, they are much more market driven insofar as, you know, people pay out of pocket. It's much less government involvement.
How would you describe the longer term economic outlook for each respective region or country?
So in the case of Europe and Japan, to some extent, they have similar outlooks. Both of them have aging populations. And so if you consider that GDP growth is driven by, you know, an increase in population times the productivity that that population creates, both have economies that are slowing. They're running at a slower rate of growth. The difference being is that Europe allows immigration, whereas in Japan, immigration is it's not very widely used as an economic tool.
Is it not allowed?
It's allowed, but it's not. How can I put this? Some might argue it's not encouraged.
Okay.
And so,
would you say that it's encouraged in Denmark?
From my perspective, I think I'm probably evidence that I haven't been disencouraged. So, and then in Australia, you have an economy that where the population has been growing. It's again very like Canada in the sense that it's resource and resource driven. It produces a lot of the things that the world want in terms of base commodities, and it attracts a growing population.
What is that, base commodities?
Things like iron ore, copper, nickel, aluminium. Okay. It's got some amongst the largest reserves in the world.
Wow. To what extent is Europe, Australia, and Japan characterized by corruption?
I suppose you look for corruption and you will find corruption everywhere. As they rank globally, I mean, if you were to look at a global index within Europe, obviously, maybe we should focus a little bit more on the individual countries. But, Europe would be seen as being a relatively low corruption in terms of, and, you know, it would be the Scandinavian countries who would be seen as at the least level, and maybe some of the southern European countries. And likewise, Australia would fit in the middle in terms of if we compared with us. With Japan might be seen as having a little bit more corruption from time to time, depending on what way it's measured. But all of these need to be taken in context of a global league. And from a global investment standpoint, these countries have very, very low levels of relative corruption.
So that makes it a lot safer to invest in?
So what it means is that you have more chance of believing what a company says, believing the accounts, believing that the government won't get involved and make laws that will, take money from investors.
So, and that's a big problem in Asia, like China?
It's not a big problem. I wouldn't describe it as a big problem, but okay. It is a bigger issue there. And certainly more recently in countries like China, for example, property rights have been called into question. And whether, how involved the companies get. I mean, some people are actually calling China uninvestable at the moment. That's not a word that we're using, because uninvestable would mean it's impossible to invest there. But it's certainly a trickier investment, and you need to do more due diligence in looking at things that maybe you could possibly take for granted in the three countries we're talking about.
I just got to thinking about, so this podcast is recorded a few weeks prior to it being published. And today there's a lot of talk about how Vladimir Putin has taken over Carlsberg's business in Russia like that. With no warning, I guess. It sounds like from the Carlsberg's communication that it's been without warning, and they have no idea what's going to happen next. Would you call that corruption, or is that in regard to China making policies that can hurt investors, global investors, fairly quickly. So you thought it was a good investment, but then the rules were changed, and then it wasn't a good investment. So is that corruption, or what do you call that?
Well, I think you need to differentiate. We've talked about two things there. So when we invest in any company in any country, a government has the right to change the rules. I mean, if the rules, the government has voted, it's democratically voted. The rules can change, whether it's regarding utilities, regulation, whether it's regulation around social media and privacy. That's all totally acceptable. I think the example you made there with regards to Russia, I mean, that is at the extreme level of where there is corruption. And, you say Carlsberg maybe didn't know. Well, they would have had a good guess because they did it to Danone, the French company, a few days before. And it's not the first time. We've seen issues where Russia repossessed oil assets from public companies.
So yeah, they have a history doing that.
There's a company called Yukos, which was owned by gentleman, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was an opponent of Putin. And those assets were seized, and Western investors were left without money. So, it's not the first time we've done this. And, from our perspective, we have really shied away from Russia for those exact reasons, because it's not a high a very low probability. It's a possibility that you will lose money through that, through corruption in Russia. And so for that, it makes it, even before the Ukraine issues, it made it an unattractive market for us.
So it goes from, on one end, being like total corruption, but in the other end, it's just politician making rules totally allowed. But then when you like slide over to the other side, it ends with corruption. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it can end. But I mean, corruption can manifest itself in all sorts of different ways. So you can have it at a macro level where politicians make regulations, where maybe those regulations are influenced by someone who's paying them, who will benefit from those regulations. And then you can have it at a micro level where corruption will take place, where, you know, monies will be taken out of businesses. You can have perhaps businesses being moved around under parent companies, etc. And that can sometimes happen where minority shareholders are disadvantaged. And that's another form of corruption. And then you have extreme state-sponsored corruption, such as the examples you've used in Russia.
Okay, so lots of corruptions to go around, but not in these regions that we're talking about
these
today.
These regions, it's pretty quiet, safe and quiet on that front.
Pretty safe and quiet. How do these regions manage various crises? We've seen the dot-com crisis, the global financial crisis, and the latest with the pandemic.
So we live in a globally connected world, and when crises take hold, at least at a market level, it tends to be very much driven by money flows. And when money flows get squeezed because of a crisis, because people turn risk averse, it doesn't really matter if Australia wasn't at the center of the global financial crisis or Japan wasn't at the center. These countries will probably struggle because there's no safe havens in that case. It just becomes a market-driven liquidation, and that will disproportionately hurt more illiquid companies, and sometimes they can be the companies that aren't involved. And so that can often, Europe, I think, probably fell more than the S&P during the great financial crisis.
Can you just put a few more words to that, being liquid, illiquid companies?
So during an event like a financial crisis or the dot-com bubble, people turn risk averse and they want to convert. So they have a low risk appetite. So they want to move their money into.
They want to feel safe again.
So they want to move their money into cash as quickly as possible. And so they will try and sell their portfolio. And as they sell their portfolio, the more liquid the portfolio, the less of an impact it will have on the price of that portfolio. But the more illiquid assets, such as US equities are more liquid because they're more widely traded than European and Japanese, will often get marked down more during a financial crisis or a dot-com crisis than the actual country where the crisis is actually happening. That's what we've observed before.
Okay, I almost understand it. Can you just say a bit more?
Yeah, sure. It's a higher beta. It's a higher beta market, and so I suppose it's when people take their money out, if there are not enough people who hold the companies to sell the companies, the companies will get marked down at a lower price.
Oh, okay. So if everyone wants to sell and there's no one left to buy,
correct,
the company is gonna get
the price will fall by more to attract potential buyers.
Yeah. And that would be worse off countries with less
buyers and sellers.
Yeah,
example. Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Because the U.S. tends to be the deepest financial market, so even though
with most sellers and buyers.
Yeah. So even though it was at the center of the global financial crisis and at the center of the dot-com bubble.
The stocks didn't fall the most.
Ironically, stocks in Europe and in Japan often fell more than they did for that reason. And so the reason
unfair.
Well, life is it is unfair. But I mean, if you're a long-term investor, that creates sometimes opportunities.
Yes.
So, we consider that sometimes irrationality. And so that will often create opportunities. So, you know, if you're a long-term investor and for the long haul, that's fine because
you should see on sale signs.
Yeah, on sale sign, it tends to reset itself. But it's hard, you know, for you to be immune from these issues.
Yeah, or feelings,
because we live in a global world.
Yeah,
and even though the dot-com bubble may not have impacted Denmark, or even though the global financial crisis may not have impacted Australia, it will impact the shares just because of this reduction of global liquidity, because of this people wanting to feel safe again, as you said, and moving more to cash.
Yeah, we're getting scared either way.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. To conclude this first part, to what extent is there economic stability in these regions?
The regions are all very stable. They have recessions, they have ups and downs, but I would characterize Europe and Japan as low growth economies. I think both are expected to grow around 1% this year and maybe a little bit less next year, which is slightly below what the world economy is expected to grow. Australia would be a little bit of a faster growing economy. And up until recently, I think Australia had a run of about 30 years where it didn't have a recession, which is, they used to call it the lucky economy.
So no recession, in 30 years?
Economic contraction. I mean, it might have felt like a slowdown if you were in Australia, but the actual economy didn't contract. It continued to grow. And that because they have this mix of resources, which was supported by China, and then it also has domestic demand and a growing population.
So they're lucky.
They are lucky.
Yeah, they are lucky. Good. So let's get to the second part of this podcast, where we focus a bit more on investing in stocks. What characterizes Australia and Japan and Europe's stock markets?
So I would say Europe and Japan have a lot of commonalities. Both Europe and Japan would be considered more value-orientated markets. They have, I would say, more cyclical companies. Europe would be the most diverse. And by diverse, I will just use a measure that the three biggest sectors in Europe would only account for around 45% of the overall market.
So the three biggest
sectors in Europe are financials, industrials, and healthcare. And so they would account for about 45% of the market. Whereas Japan, I suppose, given that it's just one country and not 44 or 42 countries, yeah, we said earlier, Japan has a more concentrated market, only marginally more concentrated. So it's around 51%, those top three sectors. The same three? Well, there's industrials, technology, and consumer companies. Whereas Australia is very concentrated. So the top three sectors in Australia nearly account for 70% of the market. And those three sectors would be financials and materials. And by materials, I mean companies like Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton, who are the biggest mining companies in the world.
So they're
mining for iron ore, they're mining for aluminium, they're mining for copper. And all of these commodities have seen huge growth as China has gone through urbanization over the last two decades. And so China has gone from, you know, consuming a very small portion of the world's commodities, iron ore, copper, and aluminium, for example, to consuming over 50%. And all of that demand has benefited the Australian
big
economy
time,
and some
I
of
think.
The companies. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they would be, in that way, Europe is a little bit more liquid, a little bit more diverse. And then in terms of valuation, all of them would be not considered particularly expensive or growth economies. They would all trade at a lower multiple at an aggregate level than the S&P 500, for example, or
American stocks.
Yeah. So the MSCI World, for example, I was just looking at this before we came in, trades on 17 times its earnings. And that would compare with Australia, which trades on 15 times, but that's because of a heavy weighting towards banks and materials, which generally trade at a lower multiple than the market. Then Europe, which trades on 12.4 times earnings, and Japan, which trades at around 16 times earnings.
that sounds fairly similar for one like me, but you say that's quite different.
Well, yeah, that would be a reasonably, well, semi-wide range. I mean, I think the U.S. trades at close to 20 times. So you have a range between of 20 times in the U.S. versus 12.4 times in Europe. So that's a pretty big range.
Okay. You're the analyst. I'm just a sociologist. Mm. So I'll take your word for it. But if you were to explain why that's a wide range, could you put some words on it?
Yeah, sure. So
what's the difference between 12 and 20?
Let's make it easy. Let's assume it's 10 because it's a nice big number and we can divide it by, if we multiply it by 2, it's 20. So if the world is trading on, if you buy a company that's trading on 20 times earnings, it will take 20 years for that company to pay you back what you buy it for. Whereas if you buy a company that's on 10 times earnings, it will take you 10 years.
That's preferable, I would
guess. It depends.
Guess.
Yes, it depends. But it's a little bit one-dimensional.
It is a big difference.
It's a little bit one-dimensional because it doesn't take into account how fast those earnings are growing. And that tends to be what the difference is.
Okay, but if you borrowed money from me and you said that you can have them in 10 years or in 20 years, that would be a big difference for me.
Yes, that would be
so, and that's what we do when we buy into a company.
Yes.
Like we borrow them some money in hopes that we're getting it back.
Yes, but you
kind of.
But you might hope that in equities also there's a growth element. So you could have a European company that's growing at, if it's 10 times earnings, it might be only growing at 3-4%, whereas that US company could be growing at maybe 10%, 15%.
And what difference is that going to make
So that's going to mean that you're going to get repaid your capital a lot quicker.
Okay.
Because when we look at 10 times earnings.
So it sounds like 20 years, but it's going to faster.
You're assuming it's not growing if you're using that kind of math.
Okay.
And so that's where the difference is.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that. I get it now. So you mentioned that that Europe and Japan was very cyclical, right?
Yes.
Yes. Can you explain that as well?
Yeah, sure. So if you look at the big companies in Europe, it tends to be financials and industrials, and in some cases, consumer companies. And that's very similar with Japan. And the reason they are cyclical, so industrial companies tend to follow a cycle. So it follows the economy, but it follows the economy much more aggressively. And likewise, banking follows a cycle, which is the credit cycle. And that tends to follow the economy as well. And so that means that the earnings tend to go up and down a lot more than, say, for example, a company like Nestle or a consumer staple, where people buy chocolate every day, they buy dog food every day, and that tends to just grow in a more straight line. And so because of that volatility that you get around the economic cycle and the volatility of the earnings and the share prices, they tend to trade at different multiples.
Great. And the other thing you mentioned was that these regions are value-oriented, and that's what you just explained before.
Correct.
That. Yes, good, good, good. Where on the risk curve are these regions and countries? Is it like very risky or not that risky? And can you...
Well, everything is relative, and all equities carry a degree of risk. And I don't think we would say anything else. But if you compare equity markets around the world, they are probably middle of the road in terms of risk. They would have probably more volatility, for example, than the United States, but a lot less volatility perhaps than emerging markets. So they would sit in the middle of that spectrum, that risk curve.
So Europe would be like middle risk?
Yeah, I would say Europe would be middle risk.
And emerging markets
would be high risk.
High risk, and US less?
Slightly less risk, yes.
Okay. I wouldn't have guessed that.
But then, of course, you've also got currency in there as well.
Yeah.
So if you're a Danish investor, you've got to consider the currency as well. And so the currency can, you're buying something in US dollars and you're translating it into kroners or euros, then you're taking a currency risk as well. So that can add a dimension of risk.
But, and is that why we end up in the middle? Because we have the currency risk as well?
Well, that,
or is that an add-on?
That would be something you would need to consider as well when investing outside of Denmark.
Yeah, because you can invest in an American stock, like single stock, and it can gain 20%. But if the
currency falls 10%, you've only made 10%. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So you need to take that into account.
Okay. And why is the States slightly less risky to invest in?
It's slightly less risky because it's a more diversified market. It tends to have an underlying economy that is more market-driven. And that might not necessarily be good from a social perspective in terms of education, in terms of whether the state pays for healthcare. But it does tend to be good for profits and earnings. And so generally speaking, and it also tends to be very good for innovation, it tends to have less regulation, and that tends to lead to a market that has faster earnings growth. And as I said earlier, the market will generally pay more for a market that has faster earnings growth. And then also, it has a lot more liquidity, because Europe is a bunch of individual markets. Japan, as I said, is one single market. But the US is a much bigger market with a lot more buyers and sellers. Is the biggest market in the world. And so therefore, it tends to be less volatile than other markets around the world where there are less buyers and sellers.
Statistically, does the US market grow faster? Like when you invest in
well,
US stocks?
Historically, it has grown faster.
Yeah.
And if you were to invest in three markets, the US, Japan, and Europe, the US has outperformed over most time periods. I think maybe during the noughties, when China
noughties?
Was...
Noughties? What is that?
2000.
Yeah. Okay.
to 2000. Yes. To 2009. During that period, non-US companies had a good time, but you know, because the US was just recovering from the dot-com crash, China was emerging. China was consuming every material known to man. It was consuming cyclical products. And that's what Europe and that's what Japan make. It had a consumer that was starting to buy automobiles, luxury goods, and that's what China, that's what the US makes, but or rather what Europe makes. Mm-hmm. And then obviously Australia also benefit from the commodities. But when you have a market where it's being driven by technology or it's being driven by innovation,
that's
how it's been for the last 10, 15 years. That tends to favor the US over other markets.
So it's like these very big things that determine which markets are preferable for a time period.
Correct.
Yeah, so that's interesting. You've already mentioned which sectors are the most important for the regions we are speaking about today. Can you say a bit about how they differ from the sectors that are in the US?
Sure. Well, as I said, if you look at the US, the biggest sector in the US is technology. Whereas when you look at Europe, it's financials. Japan is industrials. Australia is financials. So technology and communication companies, so companies like Facebook, companies like Alphabet, have a much bigger impact in the US than in Europe. And you know, it's interesting as well that, you know, in Europe, Australia, and Japan, there really are no platform companies. And that's because of a number of different reasons, regulation being one, innovation being the other. A common language often helps as well when you're trying to create a social media platform, common customs, etc., and having that huge population that the US benefits from. And so that's the reason largely that you have that. And you've Silicon Valley, which is considered, I guess, one of the centers of innovation in the world.
Yeah, because you can't really see Facebook getting where it is today if it had started in Denmark. because no, it's we had made it in Danish, and yeah. There's so few people.
But not only that, I mean, you get a network effect as well just from innovation. And so we have met Danish and Swedish and Irish companies who started off in Denmark, started off in Stockholm, started off in Dublin, but moved to the US to benefit from this network effect of working beside other companies as well. And that just creates a benefit that's very hard to replicate in some of the other countries that we're talking about. And so that's why that's big difference there. And then I suppose if you were to look at the other economies, you know, what's the difference? Well, Europe has a lot of healthcare. Europe has a lot of consumer products. It has a lot of autos. Autos.
Cars.
It has luxury. Luxury is very unique to Europe because of the heritage. So
all the French and Italian
brands?
Yes,
all the French and Italian brands and Swiss because of the heritage. Mm. And so that would be a difference. And whereas Japan tends to be very well known for some of its high-end industrial technology. So areas such as automation, robotics, are areas where Japan really does very well. It used to be consumer electronics, but now it's becoming more industrial automation and robotics that it's getting known for.
So is that bigger in Japan than it is in the States?
Yeah, that would be. I mean, so the leading robotic companies in the world for industrial would be companies like Fanuc.
Can you spell that?
Fanuc. And then companies which would focus on machine vision, which allows the robot to see. So when the robot moves its arm around to have intelligent robots, they need to be able to see. And you take in information, and if you mix that with artificial intelligence, you get these very smart robots. There's only two companies in the world who really make that machine vision at any scale, and one of them is Keyence. The biggest one is Keyence, and that's based in Japan as well.
You're going to have to spell that as well.
That's Keyence.
Ah, okay. Great. So that was just a few very specific companies from Japan. Were they both Japanese?
Fanuc and Keyence, yeah,
yes,
they're
okay.
Both Japanese.
Because my next question is if you could describe some of the larger companies in the regions. I guess if Japan is like the hotspot for automation and robotics, and they have these two companies, do we do anything in Europe that we're the best at? Or?
Yeah. So let's talk about the four biggest companies in Europe.
Yes.
So the four biggest companies in Europe, the biggest company is Nestlé. And so Nestlé does very well is it premiumizes consumables such as pet food, such as chocolate. Yes, we know about the chocolate, mm-hmm. Nutrition, and coffee. So that's
very popular things.
So yeah. Nestlé is Swiss chocolate. It's an expertise. You don't really hear of Japanese chocolate. It's not really that wide, but Swiss chocolate is recognized around the world. So think of it that way.
Yeah, but you both have the chocolate, the pet food, and the coffee.
Yes,
that's a very strong trio. What was nutrition
as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then the second largest company is a company called ASML, which is probably not as widely known as Nestlé. And ASML is an advanced semiconductor manufacturing company.
So is that a bit unusual for Europe to have a semiconductor company?
Yes, and for it to be number one in the world and one of the most important companies in the world.
Which country does it...
It's a Dutch company.
A Dutch company.
Yeah, so it was actually spun out of Philips many, many years ago. And what ASML does, if you think about it, to put it simply, is it allows you to put more and more technology on a single piece of silicon. And so if you think about the first ever iPhone, it was built on a 45-nanometer chip. And if you think of what the first iPhone could do, it was like an iPod with a phone. And then if you think about today's iPhone, which is a mini computer where you do your banking, you do your social media.
We live all our life.
We live off it. It's built on a much smaller chip, on a 7-nanometer chip.
So it was 45
down to around 7.
Okay.
And
it can do more.
And it can do more with less energy. And the idea of doing more on less is created through this shrink technology that ASML make. And they're the only company in the world who can do that at an advanced level. And so that's a critical company. It's been in the news recently because without ASML, China can't make advanced semiconductors. And so it's a very important company. And then LVMH, Moët Hennessy, is the third biggest company. And so, again, if you think about what they're famous for Louis Vuitton bags. They're famous for Hennessy. They're famous for...
What is that? Is that...
For
Hennessy?
It's a brandy.
Yeah, okay.
Cognac. Champagne, perfumes. So again, they own Tiffany now. So with the diamonds.
Yeah.
Tiffany. And then the fourth biggest company is a little known Danish company called Novo Nordisk.
Really? Is that the fourth biggest in Europe? Wow.
So ASML will shrink our technology and Novo Nordisk will shrink our bodies.
That's four very important companies.
Yeah. So that's their companies in Europe. And then if we move to Japan and think about the four biggest companies in Japan, they're, again, not that well known, but two of them are. The first one is Toyota Motor. So Toyota is the largest motor company in the world, I believe, still. It makes the largest number of automobiles. Then we have Sony. So Sony started off making wonderful consumer products. But now Sony is much different.
Did you just say wonderful consumer products?
Yeah. Well, the Walkman, for those of us old enough
to remember. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
But that was probably a Sony.
Yeah. And now they make, now they're better known for their movies. They're better known for their music. They own
Hollywood movies?
Yeah, Hollywood movies. They own theaters. So Spider-Man movies, they're all Sony movies.
Wow, okay.
They are known for their gaming, PlayStation, which anyone who has children would be very aware of the amount of time that's spent on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big, diverse consumer technology group. And they also have a semiconductor business, which it enables, it's the technology that allows cars to see. It creates vision. It comes from camera technology. So they have a CMOS business that's called... It fits into cameras, it fits into mobile phones. It allows us to have those sort of phenomenal pixels on our phones. But it will then also allow us to have sensors on our cars and cars that can effectively see and collect data. And then the last business is a business called Mitsubishi UFJ Financial, which is just a big Japanese bank.
Did you say Mitsubishi?
Mitsubishi UFJ.
That's also a car?
Mitsubishi is a conglomerate. It does loads of things. It does air conditioning.
Okay.
It does industrial equipment. But this Mitsubishi is the bank.
Okay, so the bank part of Mitsubishi.
Yeah. And so they're all...
I missed number three. So Toyota, Sony...
Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. Kians. The company
that was
we
Kians.
Talked about earlier.
Yeah,
on.
Okay. So Fanuc was not...
Fanuc is somewhere further down the list.
Yeah.
It's a slightly smaller company.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yes.
And then in Australia, you have two banks, Commonwealth Bank of Australia and National Australia Bank, which are two of Australia's four or five large banks. Then you have BHP Group, BHP Billiton, which is one of the biggest producers of iron ore in the world. And so iron ore, which is mined out in the Pilbara, out in Western Australia.
So it's a mining company?
It's a mining company.
What they did you call it? BHP
Billiton. They also do copper. They also do aluminium. So it's a diverse, but mainly it's iron ore that drives the profitability of the company. And then you have a healthcare company called CSL. And so CSL provides blood medicine. So medicine that helps people with blood diseases, etc.
And that's the fourth biggest company in Australia?
Yes, that's the fourth biggest company in Australia.
That's very specific.
Yeah, very specific.
But of course, Novo Nordisk is very specific as well. Wow, that was very interesting. All of these 12 companies are very different. Also in their LVMH is very cyclical, right? Isn't that
actually it's not, a lot less cyclical than you would think.
Yeah, it should be cyclical, but it's not.
It's not, because LVMH sells to how can I put this? It sells to rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And
they always have money.
And they always have money, correct. And so even during the great financial crisis, I think LVMH's organic revenue was more or less flat, whereas you would have thought it should have collapsed like everything else, I mean, the overall economy. And so it's been very, very resilient. So it's not nearly as cyclical as you would think.
What about some of the others then? Because Nestlé has a very stable...
Nestlé is very stable.
Yeah. LVMH is then also very stable, which is unusual.
ASML is reasonably volatile.
Yeah.
But it's so volatile.
That's up and down.
Up and down, but moving up in a general direction upwards. Yeah. It follows the semiconductor cycle.
And then Novo is a healthcare company, so that should be...
Well, it's on the up at the moment because of its obesity franchise. Yeah. But it can be volatile as well.
It can?
Yeah.
But shouldn't healthcare be like one of the more stable
They should, sectors? But it's open to a lot of news flow at the moment around its obesity drug, and will there be competition? Will there not be competition? Has it got enough capacity to make all the drugs it needs to?
Yeah.
Will but if regulation...
If you talk healthcare in general...
Healthcare in general is a more stable.
Yeah. And then what if you take the Japanese countries, Toyota, Sony, Keyence, and Mitsubishi Bank?
Yeah, they're all pretty volatile companies, okay. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, and the Australian ones, we had two banks, so that would be volatile?
Reasonably, or? And then CSL and BHP Billiton would have reasonable volatility as well.
Okay, so Europe would be the more stable region of these when you look at the biggest companies?
Yes, probably.
Yeah, okay,
interesting. I think that's fair to say.
Okay. Now to a totally different question. How important is the green agenda in Europe, Australia and Japan, like sustainable investing?
So when we talk to companies in Europe, it depends which region you're in. By and large, most people are tuned into the sustainable agenda, far more so, for example, than in the US and far more so than in China. In Australia, they are very, very tuned in to the sustainable agenda. I mean, even companies like BHP Billiton that are involved in the mining business, which is a dirty business, but if we're going to have electric vehicles, you're going to need copper. It's very hard to make steel without iron ore, and steel goes into so many important things that we make today. But they are becoming a lot more sustainable in the way that they talk about their processes.
Well, how come do you think that is?
Because investors in the region are pushing them to do that. So just like in Scandinavia, just like in Europe, and Australia has got investors who are very, very focused on how their companies earn their profits, and much more so than, for example, in the US or, again, in China. And then Japan would fall a little bit behind. You know, Japan has had a bit of a tricky history in terms of its corporate governance. It's not really been known particularly well for equality in terms of gender, etc., in terms of representation. So they're starting to talk about it because it's becoming a European investors such as ourselves, for example, will push them and have demands.
Yeah.
And so they're starting to become realize it's more important. But not just because European investors are pushing them, but also because they realize that to future-proof their business and to make their businesses more sustainable in the longer term, a lot of the things that are being suggested, you know, it makes more sense to have diverse boards. It makes more sense to have good corporate governance. It makes more sense to make products that don't pollute the environment. It makes more sense to use less energy because less energy, more profit. I mean, it's a cost. So a lot of the things that they're talking about doing is just common sense. So they are becoming more. But I would say Australia and Europe would lead the way there over certainly Japan and also the US for that matter.
Would you say that Japan is also behind the US?
Oh, that's a tough one. Yes, probably, because of the governance.
Yeah.
The US makes up for it on the governance.
Are they just like a bit more old-fashioned or?
Yes, very old-fashioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Why do investors choose to invest in Europe, Australia, and Japan? If you say that the US are just like...
Well, for diversification. So
with, of course.
With the exception of maybe ASML and a couple of robotic companies, you know, if you want to go for technology or invest in technology, the US is probably the best market to go to. Innovation, Europe is pretty good as well. But, you know, if you want to find cool consumer companies... Europe
is cool.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, of course you are.
That's not an endorsement, is it?
No.
So if you want to find, you know, but interesting companies with good products, so Nestle.
I definitely want cool companies.
Yeah. Nestle, for example, and
yeah.
LVMH, Richemont. I mean, these are all companies that, you know, are you can find in Europe, and they're very different to the companies that you find in the US.
So that's a totally different exposure.
Yeah, and so likewise, if you want to invest in, you know, companies that focus in robotics or for companies that focus on consumer technology, sometimes Japanese companies can fill that bridge as well. And then, if you want to find companies that are leading edge in terms of their commodity resources, Australia is a place that you can go to as well there. And so for diversification, that's why people, I think, go invest there.
Yeah, and that's like that's really a good bridge into our next question, because when you're sitting in Denmark as a private investor and you have to... you want a diverse portfolio, so you want the stability that a diverse portfolio gives. Is it like can I go out and pick the right mining company in Australia, or pick the right technology company in Japan, or can we like should we rather go with a fund like a global fund or someone who chooses stocks for us in those regions, and then just if we want single stocks we can like do it the Danish stock, so we get Novo and a couple more?
Sure. Well, it depends on an investor's confidence, and an investor is confident to
I know a lot of confident investors but lost a lot of money.
Okay, well,
confident.
But if investors think that they can go and they can pick companies, you know, they can look and they can go to their bank and see if they can buy these companies overseas. But if they don't, if they feel that that's too much of a challenge, or maybe they were too confident before and maybe they lost money and they wanted to put it into a strategy that would be more diverse, there are plenty of mutual funds, collective investments, or ETFs available where you can invest in this. And we have our Sea Worldwide Global strategy that invests in all of these countries. And we also then have an ETF, OSEA, which invests in all of these countries, excluding the US. So
I'm not sure private Danish investors have access to that one.
I think they do in Danske Bank.
Oh, in Danske Bank?
Yes.
Only?
Well, I don't know if only, but certainly in that bank.
Okay, I'm just going to check up on that so I can write in the text that follows this episode what the rules are.
Yes, I'm told that we can do that. Yes.
Good. And that was the whole world except US?
Yes. So we would be more focused on Europe and Japan.
Okay. Because a lot of global funds are not that...
A lot of global funds will come up with a lot of US
equities.
So if you just wanted to
focus... A lot.
Yeah. So if you wanted to focus a little bit more on Europe and Japan, an ETF for the... World ex Japan, World ex US would be for you.
And what about Australia? How do we get exposure to Australia?
Well, Australia is a very small part of the world market,
yeah.
And it's also a very small part of the world ex US market. So unless you buy an ETF that's directly in Australia, it can be sometimes difficult to get pure exposure to Australia. But if you're investing in a European a European strategy. The big mining companies in Australia are also listed in Europe.
Oh, okay.
So the two big mining companies, BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto, are also listed in Europe as well. So you can get exposure to
them. So just like Novo is listed in Denmark,
correct,
but also in the States.
Correct.
Okay. And how come that is? Because
historical reasons, the dual listing. And also because I think these companies want to appeal to a broader global audience.
So not just their own citizens just Australia, in Australia.
Not just Australia.
Okay, okay. Great. This leads us to the end, and we've almost used an hour. So what is the most important thing for our listeners to take out of this conversation?
Well, I think the most important thing, as we've talked about, is there's opportunities all over the world. You can buy great cool companies in Japan. You can buy great cool companies in Australia or in Europe or in the US for that matter. But perhaps that you should be diversified. Because as we talked about earlier on, volatility is something that gets reduced as you own more companies. You can't hide from volatility, as we said. If there's a dot-com blow up or if there's a COVID blow up, you're going to feel it. There's no equity investment that will 100% protect you from it. But you're better off being more diverse.
What would be the right amount of stocks in a portfolio, in your opinion?
Well, in our opinion, it's 30.
30.
Yeah.
Very exact.
Yes, that's we for the last 30 plus years have invested in a maximum 30 companies in our portfolios. And so even if we see a company that we think is fantastic and it's 31.
And very cool,
it doesn't go in unless we take one out. So we'll always have a max of 30 companies in the portfolio.
That is maybe good for private investors to just hear that once in a while, because I know people who have maybe like 90 single stocks and 30 funds.
Yeah, that's
like
a lot.
New investors, yeah. But we hear so much, and well, that sounds good, and that sounds good, and maybe we're inclined to keep all of what we buy, so not sell anything. So I love that you have that 30 cap. So one in, one out, I believe you say.
Yeah, one in, one out.
Yeah. I think a lot of private investors, like myself, could benefit from doing that.
Well, what we say, and this is just our opinion, is that, you know, above 30 or, you know, what you gain in diversification, you lose in knowledge and conviction and understanding.
Yeah, and it's so, very difficult
and you lose
to
track.
Follow.
Yeah, it's like herding cats, as they say. If you have too many, if you have 90, you don't know
I
what direction they're going.
I think 30 cats would be a bit much, even for me, and I'm definitely a cat person. I just want to be sure that the companies you mentioned were just the four biggest companies in every region. So it's not a recommendation. It's
correct.
Just the biggest companies.
Correct.
Good, good, good. That was great, Pete. Thank you so much.
Super. Thank you.
Det var denne uges episode af Vild med Aktier. Jeg håber, du fik noget ud af den. Du er altid velkommen med feedback på min mail. Det er som@cworldwide.com. Ligesom du kan give os en rating der, hvor du har hørt denne her podcast. Vild med Aktier udgives for den danske investeringsforening C Worldwide. Mit navn det er Sara Ophelia Møs. Jeg håber, vi høres ved næste onsdag, og så er der bare tilbage at sige tusind tak, fordi du lyttede med.